Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. And last time we finished chapter 4 with verses 15 to 17. So verse 15, "For ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that." Verse 16, "But now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil." And verse 17, "Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin." And that's where we left off last time. And Lord willing, we're going to start chapter 5 in this reading. And I'll go ahead and begin verse 1. "Go to now, ye rich men, weep and howl for the miseries which shall come upon you." Before I come to the particular verses of this paragraph, it will be necessary to premise somewhat concerning the persons to whom it is to be referred, for it seems strange that any should be so vile under the Christian name and profession as to oppress and persecute their brethren, and that even to death. In these times of persecution, to condemn and kill the just and draw them before the judgment seats, etc. Briefly then, though the main of the epistle concern the godly, and the principal intent be their instruction and comfort, yet he takes occasion many times to speak to the ungodly and unconverted amongst them. The ancient holy seed was now upon the dregs, guilty of oppression, injury, and all manner of profaneness, and because these lived dispersed and intermingled with the godly and those that were gained to the Christian faith, he takes occasion to divert and direct his speech to them. "That you may not look upon this as an uncertain conjecture, give me leave to produce my grounds and reasons. Number one, I may argue from the inscription of the whole epistle to the 12 tribes promiscuously, without any express mention of their holy calling or faith, which is usual in the other apostolical epistles. Number two, from the common and civil form of salutation, greeting, the apostles writing to Christians do solemnly wish them grace and peace, etc. From the style, this is number three, from the style, which is more rousing and pressing than usual, as intended for the awakening of secure sinners and persons carnal. Number four, the last verses of the epistle seem to intimate that much of his scope was to convert unbelievers. See James 5, 19 and 20. Number five, here he plainly speaks to rich, wicked men, though the truth is, not so much for their sakes as the sake of the godly, to encourage them to patience. For I like Calvin's judgment well, that these six verses are not so much an admonition as a denunciation, wherein the apostle does not so much direct them what to do as foretell what should be done to them, that the godly might be encouraged to the more patience under their oppressions, for that the apostle infers plainly in verse 7. I have been long in prefacing, but I hope you will judge it necessary, it conducing much not only to the opening of this paragraph, but of many other places in the epistle. From the whole, we may learn, observation, that we must not so altogether mind believers, but that we must give unbelievers their portion, terror to whom terror belongs, as well as comfort to whom comfort. Christ's sermon chiefly aimed at the disciples' profit, profit, but yet there are many lessons for the multitude, Matthew 5, verses 1 and 2. Jesus, when he saw the multitude, called his disciples and taught them, the disciples in the people's hearing, and so intersperses many things that are of a general use and profit. Again, profit. Now he goes through the words of the verse. Go to now, the phrase we opened before, it is a kind of exciting or calling them to the throne of God's judgment. Ye rich men, he does not threaten rich men simply, but such as are afterwards described, carnal rich men, such as were drowned in pleasures, puffed up with pride, worldly, wicked, oppressive. And though he used the word rich, Yet the threatening is applicable not only to those that abuse their wealth, but also their greatness, public place, authority, power, as to princes, judges, magistrates, and their officers. Because the apostle speaks indefinitely, ye rich men, something is notable, observation, that it is hard to possess riches without sin. Riches are called the mammon of unrighteousness, Luke 16:9, because they are usually possessed by wicked men, the men of God's hand, Psalm 17:14, and because they are most adored and admired by wicked men, and because they are often gotten by unrighteous dealing and hardly kept without sin. It is a hard matter to have them and not to be hindered from heaven by them, Matthew 19:24, not to grow proud, sensual, or driven by your senses, things pleasing to the senses, injurious, carnal, and worldly. We see the beasts as boars and bulls, when they are full and in good plight, grow man-keen and fierce. So do men wax insolent in the midst of their abundance. Well then, do not covet riches so much, or please yourselves in the enjoyment of them, but look to your hearts with the more care. It is an easy matter to offend in the midst of outward fullness. A long coat will soon be dragged and turned into a dirty rag, and a short will not cover nakedness. The mean or the low is best. See Agur's choice in Proverbs 30, verse 9, when he says, "Give me not riches," he adds, "lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord?" There is no condition of life begets insolency and contempt of God so much as a luxurious fullness. But you will say, "What would you have us do? Throw away our estates?" I answer, no, but, number one, prize them less. When you possess them, let them not possess you. Shall I value unrighteous mammon, the portion of the men of God's hand? No, let me have the favor of God's people. Psalm 106, 4 and 5, and Psalm 119, 132. A man cannot know love and hatred by all that is before him. Riches are given to the good, lest they should be thought evil, to the bad, lest we should think them the only and chiefest good. Number two, do the more good. Duties recovered out of the land of difficulty are the more commendable. Make you friends of the unrighteous mammon, Luke 16, verse 9. It is usually the matter of sin. Do you make it the matter of duty, or make it the matter of duty, instead of it being sin? The more liable we are to sin in any estate, the more commendable every way is the duty of it. Number three, seek God the more earnestly for grace. In a full estate, you need it much, his grace. It is not simply and absolutely impossible for a rich man to go to heaven. Poor Lazarus rests there in the bosom of rich Abraham. God can loosen the heart from the world so as riches shall be no impediment to hinder you from heaven. Whatever difficulties we are told of in the way to heaven, they serve only to make us despair of our own strength and abilities, Matthew 19:26. And he goes on onto the next words in the verse, weep and howl, or weep howling. The first word is proper to the sorrow of man, or the reasonable creatures, and so it notes the height of the calamity. It would be such as would make them howl like wolves in the evening. Howling is a sign of great grief. Nature, overburdened, strives to give it vent by loud complaints. Some observe an allusion. They that had lived after the manner of beasts, like hounds and wolves, are here bidden to howl like beasts. But this may be a strain of wit, maybe trying to read too much into the verse. That inquiry is most necessary and solid, whether this be spoken here by way of counsel or commination. Some think it's spoken by way of counsel, as if he would have them prevent their judgments by godly sorrow. Observation, The truth is, this is the way to escape judgments when we mourn for them before they come. After great showers, the air is clear. It is better weep and howl in a way of duty than in a way of judgment. There will be a weeping and howling hereafter, but it will be to no purpose. Cast them into utter darkness, where shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. But I rather look upon it as a threatening, this part of the verse, a threatening and a denunciation of judgment than an advice or invitation to repentance, partly because it is usual with the prophets to utter their threatenings in an imperative and commanding form, especially when they would note the sureness of judgments as if already come, as here, weep and howl. And the prophets do so to check their present security and jollity to whom they speak. See the 15th and 16th chapters of Isaiah and Jeremiah 48, verse 36, etc. Partly because our apostle seems to cut off all hopes from them, for the miseries that shall come upon you, not lest miseries shall come upon you. And partly because his main drift is to speak to the poor Christians that they might be the more patient under the oppression of these great men by showing that their prosperity should not always last, these great men's prosperity. Now from hence observe, observation one, that many that frolic away their days have more cause to weep and howl. Go to now, etc., that is, you are merry and voluptuous and dream of nothing but golden days, without the least thought of the miseries that are hastening upon you. After fine weather comes a storm, and when the wind is still, the great rain falls. They that were to go first into captivity had their merry banquets, Amos 6, the first seven verses. Well then, learn that they are not most happy who have least trouble, but who have least cause. Observation 2, again you may observe from the pressing of the rich to howl and his endeavor to wean them from their jollity, go to now, etc., that riches and outward enjoyments are a sorry ground of rejoicing. This is a joy that may end in sorrow. The rich are called to howling. When rich men are troubled, we ask what such a man should ail. The barbarous Irish ask why they mean to die. But the judgment of God and the world are contrary. His thoughts are not as your thoughts, Isaiah 55:8. The world thinks that none have more cause to rejoice, and God that none have more cause to mourn. Well then, look to the ground of your rejoicing, Psalm 94:19. In the midst of my sad thoughts, thy comforts delight my soul. Christians should look to the rise of their contentment and be sure their comforts be such as flow from God. What a difference is there between David and the carnal fool in the gospel? David bids his soul be merry upon this ground. God is the light of thy countenance, Psalm 42:5. And the fool says, soul, eat, drink, and be merry. Upon what ground? Thou hast goods laid up for many years, Luke 12, verse 19. Observation 3, again from that weep and howl, nothing but woe to them, as if they were past hope and counsel, and only left to terror and threatening. He had said, go to now, before to the ambitious traffickers, James 4:13, but he instructs them, and only threatens these. Rich sinners are most incurable. The reason is prosperity begets security. Hosea 12, verse 8, and Ephraim said, I am become rich, I have found me out substance. They shall find no iniquity in me that were sin. Because they were rich, they were not sensible of their civil crafts and subtleties. Besides, these are seldom faithfully reproved, and when they are most unwilling to bear a reproof. They storm at it, as if their greatness should bear them out. Jeremiah 5, verse 5, I went to the great men, but they had dissolved the bands and fully broken off the yoke. The meaning is, they had cast off all manner of respect and subjection to the law of God. Well then, you that have great estates, beware of these two things, security in sin and storming at the reproofs of sin. Salvian, in his fourth book, De Gubernatione Dei, I guess maybe the government of God or something like that, or of God's government, said that he could not speak against the vices of great men, but one or other of them would be objecting. There he meant me, he hit me, and so storm and fret. Alas, as he replies, it is not we speak to you, but your own consciences. We speak to the order, but conscience speaks to the person. Now the next words in the verse, for the miseries that shall come upon you, but what are these? Partly sore afflictions in this life, and partly hell torments in the life to come, both may be understood. Number one, the temporal miseries which lighted upon Jerusalem, Christ foretold them, Luke 19:43 and 44, and they came to pass about some 40 years after his ascension, and Josephus talks about them, as also the calamities which everywhere attended the people of the Jews, wherever they were scattered, especially in Alexandria, a city in which the Jews were two parts of five, yet were they ransacked, and by the command of Flaccus, forced into a strait place of the city, without sustenance, food, or fresh air, where they were not able to stir one for another, and if any straggled abroad, they were knocked down and slain. Many were smoked and choked to death in a fire, where they wanted or lacked fuel to burn them outright. 38 of their counselors and rich men were sent for, dragged through the streets, scourged to death, etc. This may be intended in part. And number two, hell torments, which are indeed miseries to come. The other are but the beginning of sorrows to what Dives or the rich man in the gospel felt in the flames. See Luke 16:24. From all observation, that sore miseries and judgments shall come upon wicked men. How will ye rich men for the miseries, etc. Thou shalt not be miserable as a murderer or a fornicator, as Salvian glosses, but as a rich man, because you have ill-used your wealth, at least not employed it for God's glory. See what a strain of threatenings there is against rich men in Luke 6:24-25. Woe unto rich men, for you have received your consolation. Woe unto you that are full, for you shall hunger. Woe unto you that laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep, etc. So Isaiah 5:8, woe to them that join house to house and field to field, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. It is notable that in both these places, words that do merely imply riches are used, though the worldly man be intended that places all his delight, love, care, confidence, and glory in his riches. To rich men, much is committed. They have more opportunities and obligations to do good than others, and yet usually have least hearts, and therefore they are called to a more severe account in this world and the world to come. Sometimes in this world, God reckons with them. In all changes, rich men have the greatest proportion of calamity. The winds shake the tallest cedars most sorely. God loves to bear down the strong oaks, Amos 2:9. But in the world to come, they come sadly to know what it is to have a portion only in this world. God will not give you a double heaven. Oh, who would for a temporal heaven adventure on eternal hell? Oh, then, if there be any worldly, wicked, rich man that hears me this day, go to now, weep and mourn for the calamities that are coming upon you. You will say, we do no hurt with our wealth. Aye, but what good do you do? Your garments are moth-eaten, and your money rusted. You are wretched and worldly, negligent in religion, careless to lay out your substance for good uses, and to him that knoweth to do good and doth it not, to him it is sin. So also the poor may learn hence not to envy worldly pomp and glory. A little with righteousness is a greater blessing and a pledge of more. All their great treasure brings but a trouble and a curse. See Psalm 37:16. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. Your little may bring you more comfort than if all their store were cast into one heap and bestowed upon you. So Proverbs 15:16, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. These are principles that are only relished by men of a mortified and contented mind. All right, that is the end of verse 1, and we will go ahead and stop there for this time, and Lord willing, go on next time. But until then, go seeking God's glory and a love to Him above all else, asking Him for these things. And may we do that each day, and Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.